This morning in the reflection, I offered the invitation or the possibility, the possibility that we can be, can recognize the conditioned nature of experience, not so much as something to do, but as what might be available to see, for mindfulness and wisdom to see. I think of wisdom as kind of naturally orienting towards seeing. These different natures of experience, its impermanent nature, its unreliable nature, its conditioned nature. Part of wisdom's job helps us see that. Helps us understand that is actually the way experience is, as it actually is. The teachings talk about conditionality quite a bit as in different ways. Some of the way it talks about conditionality is what are the conditions that shape suffering? How does the mind do that? As a description of the process, processes at work in the mind that tend to lead towards stress, suffering, confusion, unease, dissatisfaction. And then there are other teachings that point to conditions that shape the release from suffering. So the habitual ways that our mind work are all based in conditions. And the practice, the process of freedom, the process of understanding that leads to freedom is also based in conditions. Same nature of conditioning works whether our habitual tendencies or the wholesome qualities that move the mind in the direction of happiness. When this arises, that arises. When this is, that is. When this ceases, that ceases. A general statement of how conditioning works. The Four Noble Truths are also a kind of a framing of this two-part teaching on conditionality. First Noble Truth: there is suffering. the truth of suffering. And the second noble truth describes that suffering arises when craving arises. That's the way I understand the language. Sometimes it's said craving causes suffering. But the language of the Pali, the word samudaya, which is sometimes translated as arising or origin of, literally means arising with. And so a way to read the second noble truth is when craving arises, suffering arises. So the arising of craving is the arising of suffering, and that's the experience, I think, when we really feel into it, when we feel, notice what craving is. It's already suffering. It's like, it's not like when I think of a cause or something, it's like A causes B. I think of A as not being B. But in this case, the craving is the suffering. And that seems to be the kind of the linchpin, that if craving is not arising, suffering is not arising. And that's what the third noble truth says. The ending of craving is the ending of suffering. So the first and second noble truths are pointing to the conditionality, the co-arising of craving and suffering. A condition, when this arises, that arises, that framing of that conditionality. The co-arising of craving and suffering. So the conditions that lead to suffering, the first and second noble truths speak to that. The third and fourth noble truths, the third noble truth speaks to the possibility, or the kind of the statement that essentially the ending of craving is the ending of suffering. And the fourth noble truth says there is a way. There are a set of conditions that can be cultivated that will lead the mind to release the craving that leads to suffering, that is suffering. So the third and fourth noble truths are the kind of this, what are the conditions that shape freedom? Condition of the ending of craving is the condition that shapes the ending of suffering. So the craving the flavors of craving, so many flavors of craving. We could say that the flavors of craving are a whole host of unwholesome states of mind rooted in greed, aversion, and delusion. The teaching on the four right efforts encourages us to let go of unwholesome states, let go of the states of mind that arise, when they arise, suffering arises. Let go of those, abandon them. And to cultivate wholesome conditions. Conditions that shape move the mind in the direction to release those unwholesome qualities. Cultivate the wholesome, abandon the unwholesome, basic teaching of the four right efforts. Cultivate and maintain the wholesome, abandon and avoid the unwholesome. And this teaching on the wholesome and the unwholesome are it's the encouragement to let go of things that lead to suffering, let go of things that tend to condition suffering, and to cultivate things that tend to condition the mind to let go of suffering. Cultivate the wholesome qualities that support release, ease, and peace. These unwholesome and wholesome states of mind are described in the teachings in one flavor of the teachings. There are different ways they're talked about throughout the texts. But one of the ways they're talked about, or my understanding, is that there's a kind of a correlation between wholesome and unwholesome states of mind and the teaching of mental formations, volitional formations, found in the teaching on the five aggregates. That these wholesome and unwholesome states of mind are mental formations, they're volitional formations. So the shaping these qualities, these wholesome and unwholesome qualities that tend to shape either the movement towards ease, peace, or more towards suffering, they're also talked about in this exploration of the five aggregates. So I want to explore just a little bit in that terrain. So the teaching on the aggregates It's a kind of a framework that the Buddha offered. And maybe it wasn't even the Buddha's teaching. It seems to have been around. He probably adopted it for his purposes. It seemed to have been around at the time he was teaching already. The way the Buddha uses the teaching is kind of as a framework for recognizing and understanding our moment-to-moment experience. Kind of a way to look at, and in particular, look at our experience, our moment-to-moment experience, as a set of processes that interrelate, interweave, so that a moment of experience is kind of an interweaving of these five processes coming together. So there's a way that we can look at, understand our experience by recognizing that there are different processes that put together what we are experiencing, and there's nothing in those processes that is solid, stable, permanent, lasting. It's just a flow of process. So it's a way of supporting us to understand, I think of it as a way to understand our experience as a process in its process nature. Again, connected to the conditionality, a lot connected to this unfolding, lawful unfolding of the universe and in our experience, the lawful unfolding of our lives. So these five are form, physical form, feeling, basic sense of whether experience is pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, very simple kind of feeling, perception, the recognition of experience, when a sense impression contacts a sense space, a sight contacts the eye. The eye is simply taking in form and color. And there's a process in the mind that essentially kind of maybe goes into the filing cabinet and says, oh, this is kind of like that. So this is, you know, gives it this label or gives it this name. So perception is a process by which we navigate, we recognize the world, we recognize the objects of the world. This is a really helpful process. It's really useful that this happens for us. And perception can make mistakes. So we will potentially perceive something incorrectly based on context, based on prior experience, based on prior conditioning. We may, for instance, see a hose as a snake. And then a whole host of things might arise based on that misperception. But the process of perception is, just basically trying to do the best it can to recognize our experience so that we can navigate the world. So that's perception. And then there's volitional formation, this mental formation area. Volitional aspect of experience, many mental activities that include or involve volition, choice, intention. So these are the activities of mind that do something. This includes our emotions, our thoughts, beliefs, agendas, ideas, a whole host of activities of mind. And then the fifth one is consciousness. Fifth aggregate is consciousness, this simple, basic, just kind of knowing of experience. A sight, sight waves land in the eye base, and there's contact there, consciousness. There's a sight that the eye sees, so there's that consciousness. There's said to be six kind of consciousnesses. Seeing consciousness, hearing consciousness, smelling consciousness, tasting consciousness, touch consciousness, and consciousness in the mind. Just a really simple, bare knowing. So these are the five things, you know, processes. We can think of these aggregates in two different ways, and they're described in the suttas in two different ways. They're both described as kind of what we are experiencing moment to moment. So volitional formation that we're experiencing in the moment might be the particular emotion or thought or belief that's arising in the moment. The feeling that we're experiencing in the moment would be whether the experience in the moment has a pleasant quality, an unpleasant quality, or a neutral quality. So all five of these have that kind of what we are experiencing flavor. So this is one way we can understand these this teaching on the aggregates is a kind of a description of what we're experiencing moment to moment. But the teachings also describe them as processes, as kind of the how we experience things. And so the description of consciousness, for instance, is, you know, so why is it called consciousness? Somebody's asking the Buddha, why is it called consciousness? Why is it called knowing? And the Buddha says, well, because it knows. That's why it's called knowing. Why is it called perception? Because it perceives. That's why it's called perception. So it describes frames the aggregates in terms of verbs. They're an activity rather than a thing. And these activities of our mind put together the experience that results in the what we experience. So these five aggregates are kind of the engine of how our experience is created and what is created. So these five processes come together. The Buddha kind of, teases them apart, or other people teased them apart at the time of the Buddha, and he picked up on that teaching. So these processes kind of tease apart our experience, but in our experience, they come together. They interweave. So we can see them as separate functions. They can be noticed. They can be noticed as, oh, this is how the perception is working. We might notice that, you know, in sitting, we might be sitting here quietly and hear a sound. And the mind, so there's the sound, the vibration on the eardrum, and the mind identifies it. And the identification might happen as an image, an airplane, an image of an airplane. Or it might say the word airplane in the mind. That's perception doing its job. So that's, you know, that's the experience of perception in the moment. So these processes kind of interweave. They come together, and there's a teaching that kind of shows how they all weave together. It's not like we look at just this piece of it. We don't just see perception, because perception depends on the eye and forms. Perception depends on the ear and sounds. So it depends on the contact and the consciousness, the knowing. It depends on the feeling, you know, that there's a pleasant, unpleasant quality. There's a kind of a feeling there. So these all kind of come together. They relate together. So the Buddha, in one teachings, not the Buddha, actually, I think it's a Mahakachana gives this teaching on the Honeyball Sutta, in the Honeyball Sutta, where he's elaborating on something the Buddha said, and people are kind of confused, and so they say, what did he mean by that? And he says, well, here's what I understand. Based on the eye and form, eye consciousness arises. So there we have the form, the aggregate of form, and the aggregate of consciousness. They come together, happen together. Eye and forms and eye consciousness. The meeting of the three is contact. Contact is understood as a mental formation. So the eye informs, and then immediately there's this process that begins, this kind of process of there's contact, and that contact then tumbles forward into, with contact as condition, feeling, one feels. It says, with contact as condition, one feels. What one feels, one perceives. So again, these kind of all arise together. There's the eye, the sight, the consciousness and the knowing of the sight, the contact there, the feeling, a pleasant, unpleasant quality, the knowing of it, a bird, a train, a flower, whatever it is. So all of these are coming together already. We already have all five aggregates right there, just as the mind recognizes an experience. And then, you know, tumbling on from that, the Honeyball Sutta points to that what one perceives, one thinks about. That thinking is a mental formation. It's an idea. It's thoughts about, oh, that bird, what kind of bird is it? Where have I seen it before? Is it a woodpecker? So the mind starts to think about it and may proliferate, get lost in, you know, the mind just kind of running amok. And so again, the thinking about, the mental proliferation, those are mental formations. So every single moment of experience, these five aggregates are working. At times when mindfulness is strong, we might see, or it might highlight one aspect of the experience over another. At one point on one of my retreats, Saita was talking a lot about perception. And perception started getting highlighted in my experience. I think it was just the condition. He was talking a lot about perception. So I started seeing, you know, the mind started getting interested in noticing perception. So they're different of these threads of experience. It's not like one of them is happening and the others aren't happening together. It's like the mindfulness may pick out one of those threads to kind of be interested in or highlight. So a little more on volitional formations, because this is really where the conditioning is said to happen, our inner conditioning, the conditioning of our choices, our actions, how our minds shape our experience. The participation of our minds in shaping our experience happens in this realm of mental formations. There are other conditions that shape our experience. I mentioned these, I think, yesterday or I don't remember when, but there are, you know, environmental conditions, there are genetic conditions that shape what's happening. But the Buddha kind of oriented to, and in his own exploration of his mind, found that this thread of looking at mental formations, looking at the conditioning of our mind doing its thing, unwholesome, wholesome mind states tumbling on, that was the key for our understanding suffering and for suffering to come to an end. So the volitional formations are these functions in the mind. You could say they're those activities that do something. I talked this morning about getting curious about our emotions and mind states and what they do, getting familiar with their job description. Sayadaw's language, these mental formations have a job description. They have something to do. So what is it that they have to do? So these volitional formations are connected with a tumbling forward, an intention, an action, a choice, not necessarily a conscious choice that we are making. not necessarily me thinking I'm going to do this, but the energy of that volitional formation has a job to do, makes a choice. Even if we're not aware, and some mind state arises, and we're not aware of it, if that mind state arises and has some momentum, which often they do, our choices, the choices that this being makes, will be motivated by that energy, by that job, by that mind state that's got this job to do. Aversions arising, separate from that. So it's not necessarily, when I say the word intention or choice, it's not necessarily that it's a conscious thing that we're doing, but it is an activity that, it's almost like a program, right? It's a program that is saying, okay, this is what happens. This is what my job is. Like, you push that button and aversion's going. It's like, okay, separate from what's unpleasant. That's my job. It does not take a me in there to make that happen. So this exploration around kind of getting familiar with job descriptions, the job descriptions of our mind states, begins to point to that our mind states, the job that these mind states do, is basically to affect our aggregates, to affect our processes of body and mind. That's the job these aggregates have. So a curiosity about how do these mental formations, how do these emotions, and this is not just about emotions, it's also about thoughts, beliefs, agendas, all of these have a shaping quality. Some of the emotional ones are easier to kind of understand or feel into the job description of them. Like I described the job description of anger this morning, you know, the job to separate, to orient to things to separate from. The Buddha's teaching on the process nature of mental formations. I'll read this to you. This was very impactful for me when I read it. I even wrote "wow" in the margin of my Majjhima Nikaya. So this is, I'm going to interweave a couple of translations. So this is kind of a mixture of Thanissaro Bhikkhu's translation and Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation. I'm going to use the word that Thanissaro Bhikkhu uses for mental formation, which is fabrication. That works well for the wordplay that the Buddha used in this teaching. So again, the questioner is asking, so why are they called fabrications? You know, like, why is it called perception? And the other ones were, well, it perceives. That's why it's called perception. And here the Buddha says, well, they're called fabrications because they fabricate fabricated things. That's why they're called fabrications. And what do they fabricate as a fabricated thing? They fabricate form as a fabricated thing. They fabricate perception as a fabricated thing. They fabricate feeling as a fabricated thing. They fabricate fabrications as a fabricated thing. And they fabricate consciousness as a fabricated thing. So this teaching describes that the fabrications, the mental formations, are the whole engine of how our aggregates perpetuate, how our whole body-mind process just tumbles on. It is at the activity of mental formations. Again, does not require an I, me, or mine in there. This is the nature of fabrications. To fabricate fabricated things. So we can see this when mindfulness is a little more continuous, when wisdom is curious and interested. We can see that when anger arises, it distorts the face. It creates tension in the body, maybe heat, pressure, all form. So a rising of anger generates physical experience. It also tends to generate unpleasant experience. Tends to orient the mind to, or tends to have us perceiving experience through this lens of anger. So it shapes how we perceive. As I said earlier, you know, our perceptions make mistakes easily. Our perceptions are informed or influenced not only by our conditions of what we've seen and heard and met before, what we've learned in the past, but also how we are right now. And so our mental formations can influence how we perceive something. We might, when we are angry, we might perceive the expression on someone else's face as being hostile. And maybe they just have gas. And consciousness, too, is directed by these filters. What our minds choose to pick up out of the environment, because consciousness doesn't take in everything. Our mind is a little more selective than that because of, you know, there's kind of like so much here. The mind begins to, through the conditions, through the learning, the mind kind of begins to decide what's relevant and what's not relevant. And so these qualities of mind, these mental formations, begin to shape what our mind takes to be relevant and not relevant. And so we may tend to take in information that kind of confirms our perspective of anger. Our consciousness may be like, yep, okay, yep, that information, that's proves why I should be angry. And anger tends to construct more anger. So this tumbling on, we can get curious, and this is a, kind of in a way a way of exploring the job description, or exploring what does this mental formation do. Another way to look at that is, how does this mental formation affect the other aggregates? How does this mental formation do the creation of our experience? Because that's what it's doing. When these things arise in our mind, it's shaping our next, our this moment's experience and our next moment's experience. And so our mental formations are also wholesome. There are wholesome mental formations, and they also have jobs to do. So love, when it arises, I think of the job of love is to connect us. Creates the sense of connection and care. And it also orients us towards receptivity. The effect that love has on our mental formation, I mean on our aggregates, it tends to create a softness in our bodies. So our physical effect when love is arising, feeling of metta often has a pleasant quality. We perceive things through that lens, perceive things through the lens of connection and care. My experience with, I wrote here in my notes that, you know, the in terms of consciousness, that when metta is arising, we actually recognize that other people are there. Instead of being objects kind of to navigate as like these things in the world, they're actually, with metta, we actually consciously know them as people, as beings. And it tends to condition more metta, more care. So this exploration of mental formations is a big part of our practice. Just being curious about what are the volitional formations, what are the emotions, what are the moods, what are the thoughts, what are the beliefs arising. This area is so potent and powerful because when wisdom meets, when wisdom sees and experiences the wholesome mind states, the wholesome volitional formations, there's the understanding, the recognition, this is onward leading, this moves towards less suffering. And when it meets the unwholesome, wisdom recognizes this is not onward leading. The direct experience of meeting unwholesome experience is already feeling the suffering, like that second noble truth states. The arising of the unwholesome is already suffering. Wisdom knows that. So there's we might think about our mental formations. You know, I've talked about them as kind of being, they are also conditioned. They are not only conditioning, they are conditioned. And we are conditioned by the arising of our own internal mental formations. So that's one way that we can look at our experience is understand, you know, the arising of this anger or self-hatred or frustration, how is that affecting the experience? And yet our mental formations are not what? Are not not solely ours. And they've come from our interaction, our relationship with the world. They've come with our interaction, our relationship with other people, our families. So the mental formations of our families, the ideas, the beliefs of our families, tend to get absorbed. And so the sankharas, the mental formations, the Pali term sankharas, they are, it's like this interweaving or kind of place where the world influences us and we influence the world. It's not just about internally feeling, you know, this is arising. When we are feeling this arising, when we feel anger arising, we tend to put anger out into the world. People feel that. It's not just we have a little bubble here. And so other people put anger out in the world. Other people put views and opinions out in the world. And we feel that. We take it in. And so there's this kind of participation of mental formations, not just happening inside of us, but also shared. So views, opinions, ideas, what our culture has about things. We adopt them. We take, you know, we just believe them. So many of our beliefs have been formed in this way. What we believe politically, what we believe about race, shaped by our culture, our families. And these kinds of beliefs are quite hard to see because the people in our immediate circle tend to share them, and so we just take them to be true. And these kinds of beliefs are some of the more potent forces of suffering in our society, in our world. It's hard to see that they are a view or a belief because the people we're living around are sharing it. And it's not really necessarily even been taught as a, this is what you need to believe. It comes in more insidiously. It comes in more, you know, just through how you see people relate to each other. Oh, that's how you relate to people. That's how you relate to those kind of people. That's how you relate to somebody you don't know. It just is conditioned in us. So this is another part of the conditioning. And so much suffering comes from not seeing this kind of conditioning, these kind of views and beliefs. Mental formations related to the concept of race, for instance. Race itself, pretty clearly, biologically, genetically, shown to be completely a concept, no basis in genetics. And yet the views and beliefs in our culture, in culture, have conditioned beliefs around supremacy, white supremacy, conditioned racism. And so the concept there being believed, even if there isn't a basis in actuality, in what's, you know, in genetics, it's those concepts, the way our minds work, those concepts create mental formations that these people belong, these people don't belong, these people are one way, these people are another way, and then behaving from those beliefs. Our beliefs shape the world. Even with strong evidence to the contrary, even with evidence, belief persists. Well, this is another important way to understand how our minds work, where they don't just affect us. Our mental formations are contagious. Racism is contagious. Hatred is contagious. Fake news is contagious. So much suffering comes from the mental formations that are not seen as just an arising, not seen as a belief, not seen as just for what it is. So we affect each other. Our wholesome qualities are also contagious. That's good news. When we get curious about looking at our hearts and begin to cultivate mindfulness and wisdom and love and compassion, those also affect us internally. We feel the effect internally, but it doesn't stop there. We can't stop it there. Just like we can't stop anger at our, you know, at our, the edge of our skin, you know, it ripples out. We can't stop love from rippling out either. Compassion. So we affect each other. And our practice supports the cultivation of these wholesome, contagious, wholesome mind states. These wholesome states are partly cultivated. There are different ways they're shaped, they're cultivated. And we've been talking about this over these days. That first talk on the simile of the cloth, talking about how understanding leads to abandoning. So the understanding, cultivating the understanding, is cultivating the wholesome states of mindfulness and wisdom, patience, curiosity. So already the activity of exploring understanding is actively supporting the nourishment of those wholesome qualities. It's already there. The way we explore meeting our experience with allowing, honoring that quality of care, of metta, also being cultivated through the exploration of, can I understand my experience? Can I understand this experience? And often we're exploring the unwholesome mind states as we're trying to do this. So those unwholesome mind states then, in a trick of our awareness and wisdom, just become the nourishment for the wholesome states. When we're not bought into them, but curious about them. So the wholesome states are cultivated, the directly cultivated, the awareness, the wisdom, the patience, the love, all of that, just by being curious, being interested in understanding our experience. It can be any experience, including our unwholesome mind states. With that understanding, the simile of the cloth pointed to that understanding shapes, so wisdom conditions when the mind understands that job description of wisdom to understand experience in terms of what leads to suffering, what leads away from suffering, and to release the suffering. So the understanding results in the letting go, the abandoning of the unwholesome. And so that also is a cultivation of the wholesome. The abandoning, when the wisdom abandons, when wisdom allows an unwholesome quality to be abandoned. So aversion, for instance. Wisdom, explore, mindfulness and wisdom together, exploring what is aversion, how does it affect the mind and body? You know, there's the cultivation of seeing it and feeling into it. And at some moment you might experience the release from that aversion. Actually, feel the letting go. in that moment. And you don't have to feel it in a moment, but you may notice at some point, sometimes it goes like, you know, you're exploring something for a while and looking at it and feeling it like, yeah, that hurts. It doesn't feel so good. And then your mind gets, you know, pulled off into some other thought and, you know, you're off there for a couple hours. And then you remember, gee, you know, I was all wrapped up in that thing and it's just not even there anymore. So we notice that non-aversion is there, the aversion is not there. So that is also something that happens with the abandonment. Aversion released to non-aversion. Greed released to non-greed. Delusion released to non-delusion. And the Buddhist teachings also point out or tell us that the root of wholesome mind states is non-greed, non-aversion, non-delusion. So the release from the unwholesome is the root for the wholesome to arise. And again, as I often do at the end of these reflections, just remind you that this is a reflection offered to support understanding. I don't think I've talked about the Dharma rain analogy in the hall this time so far. We can kind of think about the reflections as being like a soft rain falling on the landscape of our hearts and minds and soaking in, just seeping in to the ground. And we don't have to do anything with it. At some point that this information, this kind of reflection might arise with or be available with some experience. And then something different might be seen, something new, something unexpected, or just a new way of experiencing. But you don't have to remember anything from the talk. You don't have to think about it. You don't have to try to do anything with this information. Just keep simply being curious about your experience. Let wisdom do its job. Thank you for your practice.